Before we start tonight's program, we'd like to set the stage for you for the 1915 Panama Pacific Exposition by showing you a brief clip of the actual exposition. Please take a look at the monitors on either side of the stage.
It was a great day and a great crowd. For the Tower of Jewels, beautiful beyond description, sparkling with hundreds of thousands of multicolored jewels in the brilliant sun or in the night illumination, it was the central and dominant feature of the Phantom City. In the center of the lovely South Gardens, the Fountain of Energy, flanked on either side by twin mermaid pools, greeted the eye of the visitor. And to the left was the Crystal Dome Palace Horticulture, Byzantine in architecture, suggesting the Mosque of Ahmed the First in Constantinople, housing within strange and beautiful plants from all the tropical world. To the right, Festival Hall, a shrine where music lovers worshipped, and where world-famous notables spoke to huge gatherings. And just back of the tower was the Court of the Universe, with the two famous statues, the Rising Sun and the Setting Sun. Now the Court of Abundance embraced the beautiful Fountain of the Earth. The Fountain series graced the symbolic court of four seasons. The Court of Palms, with its sunken pool containing that beloved statue, the end of the trail. Majestic colonnades surrounded the Court of Flowers and the Beauty and Beast Fountain. The Fine Arts Palace, with its priceless art treasures and its exquisite setting by the lagoon, will live in memory forever. Sculptors from all over the world brought their skill to adorn the Phantom City. Every school of art was represented. Palaces and courts and fountains all carried their quota of sculptural beauty. These few statues are but a reminder of the countless others just as lovely. And the distances were magnificent. Now here's a glimpse down the Avenue of Palms, a vision of breathtaking beauty. Machinery Hall Avenue led past the largest wooden building ever constructed and where was staged the only indoor flight in aviation history. There's only a time for a glimpse of the many state and foreign buildings, picturesque and individual, and housing rare exhibits from the far corners of the earth.
Quite something. I think you're in for a wonderful discussion tonight. And now to begin the program for our radio audience, I'm pleased to turn the program over to our distinguished moderator, Dr. Anthea Hartig, Executive Director of the California Historical Society. Dr. Hartig came to the California Historical Society in 2011 after 6 years with the National Trust for Historic Preservation, where she directed the Trust's Western office. Please welcome Dr. Anthea Hartig and our very distinguished panel.
Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. Find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download the club's engaging iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information, as well as podcasts of past programs. I am Anthea Hartig, it's all true, and I have the honor of being the Executive Director and the CEO of the California Historical Society, and I'm delighted to be your moderator for tonight's program. Today we'll commemorate the 100th anniversary of San Francisco's Panama Pacific International Exposition, known as the PPIE, the 1915 World's Fair that began on February 20th of that year, that set the stage for innovations, ideologies, tensions, legacies, all that still impact us today. This program is being held by the California Historical Society and is part of a year-long series of public events, exhibitions, and activities presented by more than 45 Bay Area cultural, civic, and business organizations to reflect on the PPIE's historical significance and cultural meaning. Check us all out at ppie100.org and us at California Historical Society or calhist.org. And we're honored to be presenting this with our core partners, the Maybeck Foundation, San Francisco Recreation and Park Department, and iHanger. Please also see, and we'd love to welcome you to our concurrent exhibition, City Rising, the larger one at Bernard Maybeck's Melancholy Masterpiece, the Palace of Fine Arts, and just down the street here at our headquarters on Mission Street. The Panama Pacific International Exposition symbolized San Francisco's transformation from a city devastated by earthquake and fire to an economic powerhouse poised to lead a social and cultural revolution in the 20th century. It featured pavilions from 21 nations and 28 states of the Union. Over 19 million people attended, and this was when a time when San Francisco's entire population was around 420,000. Celebrity participants ranged the gamut from Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, Buffalo Bill Cody, Helen Keller, Teddy Roosevelt, Emily Post, Laura Ingalls Wilder, and even Harry Houdini, to mix it up a little bit. Among the exhibits was the C.P. Huntington, the first steam locomotive purchased by Southern Pacific Railroad. A telephone line was established all the way to New York City for the first time by American Telegraph and Telephone Company. So for the first time in New York, you could actually hear the Pacific Ocean. The Liberty Bell traveled by train on a nationwide tour from Pennsylvania to attend the exposition the last time it left Philadelphia. The centerpiece of the 635-acre fair that stretched from Crissy Field to Fort Mason was the Tower of Jewels, rising 435 feet, approximately 40 or 43 stories, and modern stories when the tallest building in the city was about 11 stories. It was covered by 102,000 cut glass Nova gems. Buildings that remain today, of course, include the Palace of Fine Arts and what is now called the Bill Graham Civic Auditorium. As many of you know, it was the gift of the PPIE Organizing Committee to the city and opened on January 9th in 1915. Japanese Tea House, which was barged down to the peninsula to Belmont, and of course scattered artifacts that richly decorate many people's private and public collections. It's appropriate today that we're holding the program at the Commonwealth Club, which strongly endorsed the exposition and made a major effort to ensure that so many of its legacies were preserved. Especially, the club has served, as you know, as an incubator for civic and civil discourse. To discuss the lasting impact of the exposition, I'm very pleased to sit up here with incredible souls and historians and minds. Our distinguished panel includes, as I work my way to your left, Dr. Kevin Starr. Kevin is California State Librarian Emeritus and Professor of History at the University of Southern California. As a native San Franciscan, Kevin holds his PhD in American Literature from Harvard University and a Master of Library Science from UC Berkeley. Many of you, of course, like I, grew up as a historian at the feet of Dr. Starr and his 9 books, 6 of which, of course, are part of the American and California Dreams series. Thank you for joining us. Next to Dr. Starr is Laura Ackley, widely known, especially after the past few weeks, for her expertise on the 1915 World's Fair, and is the author, as George indicated, of San Francisco's Jewel City, the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915. Laura first became interested in the PPIE during an undergraduate course at UC Berkeley. Appropriate since Phoebe Hearst had something to do with both of those. After completing her first master's degree in architecture at Harvard and the university's Graduate School of Design, she returned to Berkeley to research the PPIE for a second master's degree in architecture and architectural history and theory. And I think Dr. Starr and I will give you an honorary doctorate for your deep dedication. Moving down is Dr. James Gantz. Jim is curator of the Achenbach Foundation for Graphic Arts at the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. Previously, he was the Manton Curator of Prints, Drawings, and Photographs at the Sterling and Francine Clark Art Institute, where he also taught at the Williams College Graduate Program. Jim holds a PhD in art history from Yale. Certainly not least, but at the end of the table here, is Laurie Fogarty. Laurie has served so beautifully and passionately as the executive director of the Oakland Museum of California, coming there after over 20 years of museum experience. She previously served as director of the Bay Area Discovery Museum and at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. Ms. Fogarty, going back down to Southern California, graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa from Occidental College. So please give a warm welcome to our speakers. I'd like to kick off the conversation by asking each of you to reflect upon this question. How important was the PPIE to San Francisco, to the region, and to the state, and what accounts for its lasting appeal and significance? And I'd like to also please to ask you to respond in the order in which you're seated. So we'll go down the line. Mr. Dr. Starr.
Well, I think the relationship to the loss of the city in April 1906 and the recovery of the city, the rebuilding of the city in such a rapid order, and I think that this is the central text, as Maybeck gives it, for the Palace of Fine Arts, which is not surprising that structure has been preserved, because Maybeck saw it as a Piranesian text in which something was lost, and there was a melancholy reflection what was lost. At the same time, the architecture evoked civilization and recovery. And I think that's number one importance. The second is, I think, that major cities go through periods of imagining themselves, and they can be imagined through their artists. We think of Balzac's in Paris, or Dickens's London, or Doblin's Berlin, or Jack London's California, Bay Area. Sometimes artists do this for a city, and sometimes cities do this themselves. Chicago did it in the aftermath of its destruction and loss in 1870, and 20-something years later came forward with this reimagining. And so in that case, the Panama Pacific International Exposition represents all the wonderful things that Laura Ackley has chronicled, but also represents in kind of some mysterious way an imaginative archetypal projection on the part of San Francisco of its identity as a city. A city of the mind, a city of imagination, a moral and intellectual construct, as well as an actual physical and socioeconomic place.
Thank you, Kevin.
That's beautiful and literary, and I'm going to be far more literal. And I have notes and feedback. So in the first decade of the 20th century, San Francisco was really the first city of the West, and it was proposed in 1904 to host the 1915 World's Fair and to have it be the first one to celebrate a contemporary event. All the previous American World's Fairs had celebrated a historic event like the arrival of Columbus, the Louisiana Purchase, etc. But the San Francisco Exposition would celebrate America's achievement in completing the Panama Canal, even though that completion was at least a decade distant. Then, in April of 1906, San Francisco suddenly developed a huge PR problem. Post-earthquake and fire images flashed all over the world, and they showed the Earth nearly 4 miles of smoking ruins and shattered masonry and the camps of the half of the population that was suddenly homeless. So city leaders quickly realized that these terrible visuals would be nearly indelible, and it would take a huge effort to replace them. So they did something quintessentially San Franciscan. No sane city would decide in the face of catastrophe to throw a gigantic party and invite the world to attend. But, of course, that's exactly what San Francisco did. By 1915, they had realized the serene Beaux-Arts palaces and courts of the PPIE, and they were the finest achievement in design of all the classic world's fairs. And within these buildings that looked to the past architecturally were housed industrial spaces that looked towards the future. It was the cusp of modernity technologically and socially. The working Ford Model T plant in the Palace of Transportation illustrated the new assembly line concept, and the airplanes that looped and swooped over the ground signaled an entirely new mode of transport never seen at a World's Fair. Important ideas in medicine, education, and engineering were discussed in more than 900 conferences during the exposition. So, mounting a successful World's Fair so soon after the disaster succeeded in the planner's most coveted goal to announce to the world, San Francisco is not a smoking ruin. We are open for business. We want your investment. We want your shipping to come through our port. And this message was carried across the entire globe, whether or not all the nations participated. So the publicity department within the PPIE, which was called the Department of Exploitation, also promoted trips within California as well as investment, tourism, and settlement opportunities. So the entire state benefited. For instance, because San Diego was holding a smaller simultaneous fair, Los Angeles promoted itself with a postcard featuring a picture of a sandwich. And it read, wait for it, "When the world comes out west to be fed, this sandwich will furnish a treat. San Diego and Frisco the bread, but Los Angeles sure is the meat." Ba-dum-bum. So when it was all over, it's estimated that more than $45 million was injected into the California economy from outside of the state, which is about $2.1 billion in 2013. And further as a legacy, tens of thousands of locals worked on building the fair, on its grounds and in its concessions, and nearly 19 million pushed through the turnstiles to hear John Philip Sousa play at his last World's Fair, to munch on candy floss, or perhaps even to fall in love under the rotunda of the Palace of Fine Arts. So even though the PPIE was not without its flaws, the descendants of those millions of people have grown up with the souvenirs and the tales of the wondrous 288 days that were the PPIE, which really make it an essential part of the fabric of the region and the state. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Laura. That was beautifully said. I love the Department of Exploitation. Nomenclature matters then and now. Yes. Jim, okay. Share with us, please.
Wow. So many thoughts come to mind. I'm really speaking about the art of the PPIE, and art was such an essential component of this exposition. It was really incredible how much art was in San Francisco. Now, San Francisco had a very strong and solid art world going back to the 19th century. You know, then as now, many, many artists were attracted to this beautiful region, which also was a real city with wealth, with collectors and galleries, and of course all of this was disrupted seriously in 1906. But from the very beginning, the organizers of the Panama Pacific Exposition, they meant for art to be a very essential component of this exposition. And one of the first things that happens in 1911, when San Francisco is identified officially as the organizing city for the next World's Fair, right off the bat, a man named Robert Harsh, who was a graphic artist and a professor at Stanford, was put in the position of a sort of temporary head of fine arts. And he immediately went out across the U.S. and started meeting with some of the great industrialist collectors of the time, and also some of the art institutions. And within a few months, he came back with promises to lend significant works of art to San Francisco. The papers reported on all of this, and in fact, most of the works of art that were promised in 1911 never made it, but a few of them did. But the point is that art was going to be very important to this fair. There were more than 11,000 works of art in the Palace of Fine Arts. I'll pause so you can sort of imagine what that was like. And if you take into consideration the art that was included in the foreign pavilions and the state pavilions and the education and liberal arts pavilions, I would estimate that there were more than 20,000 works of art here. They came from all over the world, particularly all over the U.S. And so, you know, in looking at the cultural landscape of San Francisco and how it grew in those early years, I find it especially interesting. In 1915, the Crocker Langley Directory, the phone book for San Francisco, if you looked up museums, it was pretty pathetic. There was the Memorial Museum in Golden Gate Park. This was the leftover from the 1894 Midwinter Fair that was actually a rather important little museum, but it housed, it's kind of like San Francisco's attic. It had a little bit of everything. It had a little bit of art, too, but mostly everything else but art. And the California Academy of Science was under construction. I think the Department of Mining and Metallurgy had a little gallery of minerals in the Ferry Building. That was pretty much it for museums. But when this exposition ended, a decision was made by the San Francisco Art Association to try to keep the San Francisco, to keep the Palace of Fine Arts and operate it as a museum for San Francisco. And that's exactly what they did. The Palace of Fine Arts reopened as a museum, and it functioned that way until about 1924. Now, of course, we all know about Alma Spreckels and the story of the Legion of Honor, our building up in Lincoln Park, the beautiful Legion of Honor. That was based on the Legion of Honor model in Paris, which was also the model for the French Pavilion in the PPIE. And Alma, who had lent her Rodins to the PPIE, eventually donated them to the city, and as she donated this new institution that would open in 1924. Finally, I would mention the Memorial Museum itself. This was an institution that actually became much larger after the Panama Pacific Exposition and grew to become quite an important art museum for the city of San Francisco in the wake of the PPIE. And actually a good transition to Laurie Fogarty, mm-hmm. sitting to my right, the Oakland Museum. Robert Harsh, this man that I mentioned a few minutes ago, the first director of fine arts for the PPIE, he became the director of the Oakland Museum after the Panama Pacific Exposition ended and was responsible for opening the Oakland Art Gallery early in 1916, too. So the legacy for arts institutions was very important, and San Francisco's identity as a center for art on the West Coast really comes out of the Panama Pacific International Exposition.
Great. Thank you so much. And it is a beautiful segue.
Yes, thank you. I'm very happy to be here with you all and with the distinguished panel, and happy to visit the West Bay. I want to echo a lot of these comments about the importance and the continued legacy of the PPIE. Certainly, this idea of a city literally rising on the rubble of the 1906 earthquake and the sense of rebirth, the sense of can-do American attitude, the technological innovation, and of course, the artwork, and many artists, not just with the PPIE, but responding to the earthquake and being part of the rebuilding of San Francisco. But I want to also mention another facet, which is that the PPIE was the Panama Pacific International Exposition, and it was, as Laura said, really celebrating the opening of the Panama Canal. But it was also about kind of reimagining America's and particularly California's relationship with the Pacific. And, of course, in a very different way than we would likely do today. It was a very colonial attitude. It was placing San Francisco and California as kind of the epicenter of Pacific trade and the opportunity for expansionism and future opportunities in the Pacific. California, of course, has had a very long relationship with the Pacific. So it was an interesting way to think about what is our future relationship with the Pacific. And in addition to all of the other wonderful features and artwork and pavilions, of course, there was a Japanese pavilion, there was a Chinese pavilion, there was a Samoan village, there was an exhibit devoted to Hawaiian culture and music, there was a New Zealand pavilion. So for many Californians and for many visitors to the PPIE, it was really, for better and for worse, their first exposure to Pacific Island cultures and really understanding these islands, some of which had become territories of the United States, like the Philippines and Hawaii, their first exposure to these cultures and to these people. And I think it opened people's eyes to what the future of California's relationship with the Pacific could be. And I think it has a continuing impact because we're still considering that today. We're still thinking of what it means not for California to be the western edge of European-American expansion and manifest destiny, but actually the eastern edge of the Pacific and our relationship with the Pacific. So I think there's a very important context globally for us to consider with the PPIE as well.
Great. Thank you, Lori. Yes. And I think in particular, just picking up on that, that tensions between the colonial kind of conquest of imperialism, and at the same time, especially larger, more powerful, and very culturally deep Asian nations, including China and Japan, deciding to invest and build their own pavilions, in a way kind of claiming their own agency to show their cultures as they would want to be represented rather than as they often were, and especially at a time when the powerful 1882 exclusionary acts against Chinese were in full effect. Thank you so much, all four of you. That's, I think, a wonderful overview. We've gotten some great questions so far, and keep them coming. I'll try to weave them in. I want to pause for just a minute. Laura, I think you answered part of this. One of our audience members with beautiful handwriting asked the effects of the PPIE on San Francisco's convention and tourism industry, and with an equivalency of $2.1 billion invested, you can imagine it was intense, especially because this was a destination. You know, ideally you came for weeks, you came for months. The importance of the recovery, as Laura so beautifully articulated, of we are open for business. And if you think about the one of the true lasting legacies, of course, is the quality of the hotel experience here. You might say the cost of the hotel experience here. 2,600 restaurants. I mean, you can really, I think, kind of mark that emergence. I think any of us would be happy to talk more about that.
Anthea, Laura, correct me if I'm wrong. I read in your wonderful book that 18 million people came, something like one-fifth the population of the United States, roughly, more or less, came. And that's extraordinary to think of that mass migration in within a 9 to 10 month, 11 month period.
That was, it was 18,673,000, whatever. But that's pushed through the turnstiles, not individuals.
I see.
So, of course, you're going to draw many more of your attendees from the 100-mile radius around the fair. However, San Francisco, in this process of rebuilding from the earthquake and fire, made darn sure that they were going to rebuild brand new hotels to attract people to the fair. And I really haven't done the research, frankly, on how it affected tourism out from the fair, but I will tell you that a lot of people lived in residential hotels and were forced to leave in the year of the fair because they were being reserved for people that were coming for all these conventions. And to prevent the hotels from jacking up their rates, which they said they weren't going to do, but then no one would actually sign anything that said that they really weren't going to raise their rates, the exposition went and built its own hotel inside the grounds, which made the hotelier associations very, very upset, to make sure that they were honest. And they even published a list of hotels that when you got off the ferry coming over or any of the trains, people would meet you and they would call the hotel and book it for you, and they'd give you a little card that said, this is how much you're going to pay. So if you got to the hotel and the price was mysteriously different, they would kick that hotel out of the list. So this was some of the ways they protected tourists during the fair. However, the whole idea of see America first was widely popularized as a phrase during the fair, largely by the railroads, all of whom were tremendous investors in the fair. So they were building tourism throughout the West and California, which certainly continued and echoed beyond December 4th, 1915.
Right. Thank you, Laura. Jim.
Yeah, I was just going to chime in on the numbers on the numbers question. John Trask, who was the director of fine arts for the exposition, in his final report, estimated that something like 10 million people visited the art exhibitions. Yeah. I'm assuming that means the Palace of Fine Arts, principally. That's a pretty extraordinary number. But I also wondered, too, I know that during the pre-exposition period, the grounds were actually open. People could come through. Do we have any sense of how many actually came through in 1914? And it must have been a significant number, I would think.
I'd have to look it up in the book.
But they did a lot of what we would call kind of pre-tours and, yeah, a lot of build-up. So we have some great questions coming. I'm going to answer one really quickly about the financial success of the exposition. And most certainly it was for many, but certainly not for all. It doesn't perhaps have quite the drama of the gold rush in terms of those who made it and those who didn't. But it was a complicated, I think, notion of success. For the overarching kind of answer, it would be yes, because there's also a great question on the filling of the marina and some, you know, the great urban myth that was the earthquake rubble, you know, put down there. It's actually dredge. You know, we would never do this today, but all of those 71 acres were dredged up from the bay in a phenomenal amount of environmental degradation of the shoreline, because the shoreline was malleable, right? It was ours to make, pretty much an Old Testament way of thought. But so when that was filled and all the infrastructure was laid as for redevelopment, so your investment in the fair ideally meant that you would have an investment in the future of what we now know as the Marina District. And in fact, Phoebe Hearst would arm wrestle in her genteel way investors in the fair to give their shares to the restoration of the palace instead of cashing them in. I want to go back to Laurie for a minute, because I think we have some great questions too on what you touched upon in terms of the complicated, I think, both ethnic and racial senses of identity and presentation. And I know that the Oakland Museum on May 30th is opening a wonderful exhibit called Pacific World. Have you and your curators and historians have been thinking about this? Kind of how have you kind of added to that context that the East of the East, as
right.
California is?
Right. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because this anniversary has given us so many ways to kind of rethink how we are considering our collections as well as this history. And interestingly, the Oakland Museum of California, as Jim mentioned, we have deep roots. The museum itself opened in 1969, but it came together from three predecessor organizations, one of which was the Oakland Public Museum, which opened in 1910 on the banks of Lake Merritt. And it had some incredible legacy collections, kind of like you were saying, the attic for California. One of those collections comprised about 3,000 objects that were put together of Pacific Island material from the 1880s and 1890s that were collected by an Oakland dentist, John Rabe, who went around traveling to these islands, essentially trading dental services for artifacts. And interestingly, his wife bequeathed them to the museum, and they came to the Oakland Public Museum in, of course, 1915. Now, they're incredible objects. They're tapa and kava bowls and a 25-foot outrigger from Papua New Guinea. I mean, just amazing things, jewelry and all sorts of material that have almost never been shown by our museum because they're not Californian. So this gave us an opportunity to think about, with the anniversary of the PPIE and how California was thinking about its relationship with the Pacific, to bring that material out. It had been in deep storage. We've done extensive restoration. Over 3,000 objects from the Pacific Islands will be on view. But what we wanted to do is allow these objects to kind of reclaim their history, rather than being told through kind of Western museum eyes. Traditionally, when this material is shown, it's often shown as kind of art objects, completely out of context with how they were used by their cultures. So we are working with a contemporary task force of Pacific Island people to really bring this to life as what are these stories today, looking at the PPIE as a moment 100 years ago when California considered its relationship with the Pacific, but now what is our relationship today as told particularly by Pacific Island people, and how these traditions, whether it's music or tattooing or food or shipping or all of these things that are still cultural practices today, what were they then and what are they today? So that's kind of how we're taking a bit of a different take, certainly than what was done at the PPIE in looking at these cultures, but really using the PPIE as a moment when that future was examined, and we're re-examining it now 100 years later.
Great, thank you. That's a wonderful answer. I'm going to answer some audiences from our questions from our audience again, but before I do, I have the honor of saying the following. Just a reminder for our radio listeners at home, in your car, or wherever you may be on the planet, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our topic is the 100th anniversary of San Francisco's Panama Pacific International Exposition and the continuing legacy of this amazing World's Fair. Our panelists are Dr. Kevin Starr, California State Librarian Emeritus and Professor of History at the University of Southern California, Laura Ackley, author of San Francisco's Jewel City, the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915, Dr. James Gans, the curator of the Achenbach Foundation for Graphic Arts at the Fine Arts Museum of San Francisco, and Dr. Laurie Fogarty, Executive Director of the Oakland Museum of California. I'm Anthea Hartig, Executive Director of the California Historical Society, and your moderator for today's program. You can also find the Commonwealth Club programs online at the club's YouTube channel. How fun is that? Okay. All right. We have fantastic questions. A couple of them are about the other remnants of the fair and where they all went. There's a great picture we have of the Ohio building floating away on a barge. And one in particular question is about the palm trees. John McLaren, the city's a lead horticulturist, started growing trees and other incredible flora three years before, I think, at least 1911, 1912. And so he wanted a very mature landscape. And yes, so a lot of the palms in particular were brought in. They look 100 years old. Well, not quite, but close. So, and then a number of them did make it through other parts of the city, especially parks. So some of that, it's kind of hard to track from what I know, but some of the palms in particular, which, as you know, are not native. I'm going to save these for Dr. Starr. There's a couple of good ones. I guess the PPA was a World's Fair. Oh, this is a wonderful question. The inspiration of sadness and melancholy as Maybeck's keynote for the Palace of Fine Arts, was this a historical transition between the Victorian and the Jazz Age?
Well, I think it was chronologically, but we also have to remember, and Philip Fradkin brought this out in his book on the earthquake, that we didn't manage the fighting of the fire very well in San Francisco. There was a lot of destruction that could have been avoided. And secondly, we in 1905, the Committee for the Adornment and Beautification of San Francisco produced the Burnham Plan, in which was one of the vehicles of, as I say, a city envisioning itself. So the sadness was because of the fact that this city was lost, the great city of that was created in the first 50 years, but at the same time, the fair itself is, in terms of its arrangement of avenues and squares, comes out of the City Beautiful movement and has a quality of the Burnham Plan. So the Burnham Plan is adopted as the model for the fair, while at the same time the Stockton Street Tunnel is being built, the twin within the same period. the Twin Peaks Tunnel is being built, the Great Highway is being built. In other words, aspects of the Burnham Plan are being implemented in the real world. Again, if you're a San Franciscan, you have no trouble moving from a world of fantasy and imagination to reality and back and forth. And I think you, in terms of this imagined city, to a certain extent, to include the envisioning yourself as an Asia Pacific Basin capital was part of this whole powerful reimagining of a city that was lost and reimagining its future.
Yeah, further from an architectural standpoint, Maybeck was highly inspired by Giovanni Battista Piranesi, the great etcher from, I believe, the 17th century, who was very fond of making etchings of imperial Roman ruins. And he felt that he wanted to evoke this feeling in the Palace of Fine Arts, an aura of melancholy, and he deliberately placed this rotunda and colonnades and the weeping women whom the guards were told to tell visitors were weeping over the sadness of art. But this was to provide a moment, a respite of a moment of quiet and introspection and thoughtfulness when going from the loud machinery of the exhibit palaces and all of the amazing rich goods crammed into them into the artistic spaces. So whether or not we could equate that as a transition from the Victorian to the Jazz Age, which I think is perhaps arguably more chaotic, I don't know if we can make that leap, but Maybeck did mean it to be a transitional melancholy space.
Well, in terms of those Fords being manufactured, that looks forward to the Jazz Age. You couldn't have the 20s without the automobile.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you also, I'm going to ask a World War I question in a minute because a number of you have asked about the war. But I think it's also very fair to say that we'll never quite understand the interruptions of cultural production, of women's rights, of all kinds of things due to the First World War. You know, on art, Jim, if you think about the Palace of the Fine Arts, which I know you're thinking a lot about, and that beautiful separation with the lagoon, there are a number of lagoons in that part of San Francisco's shoreline. It was a Lone trading village. You can kind of imagine it's a beautiful spot, a really key nexus there. It was one of the lagoons was called Washerwoman Lagoon for a long time because it was before it got too polluted, it was a favorite clothes washing spot. For a couple centuries. So as you have thought about curating the show, Jim's bringing back over 250 pieces of the 11,000 that hung in a show that opens in October at the De Young. How have you kind of approached it curatorially and historically?
Okay, yes, we are organizing an exhibition called Jewel City, Art from the Panama Pacific International Exposition. I know. And it opens October 17th at the De Young Museum, so we're deep in the throes of galleys and all kinds of unpleasantness. But it's going to be a beautiful show, and we've had some success. I mean, I really feel very much connected to the original organizers of the PPIE. I know exactly what they were going through, because it's hard to borrow art. And I think it must have been especially hard to borrow art and bring it to a city that was pretty much destroyed just a few years earlier. These were described as priceless art treasures in an old film that some of us saw a little while ago. And, you know, it was pretty audacious, the idea to bring priceless art treasures to San Francisco. And as I said before, the Palace of Fine Arts was absolutely packed. In fact, it was so full that they had to build an extra building, which is an option that I'm told I don't have for our show.
talk to your funders.
They put up about a 27,000 square foot Butler building, two stories, just to the west of the Palace of Fine Arts called the Annex. It didn't open until July. It was built at a cost of about $12,000. doesn't seem like any person ever photographed the outside of this building. So, but anyone who hears my voice who has a photograph of the exterior
the
of the annex, please get in touch with me.
It's right behind the Turkish building and the Siam Pavilion. Okay,
the square building.
Right. Find it. Find it for us.
Right. Yeah, the problem is that it didn't open until July, and by that time, most of the view books had already been done. A lot of the photography of the campus had been accomplished. So we're looking at the art from the PPIE, and about two-thirds of our show is about American art, and this was really the main attraction of the Panama Pacific Exposition. But we're also looking at the French art, because for us that's such an important part of the story of the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco, the Legion of Honor. So we have a gallery devoted to French art. And then I had to deal with the annex, because the annex is where
the cool stuff.
The really cool stuff comes from. This is the art from Europe that came in at the very last minute with great drama and difficulty, including the first display of Italian Futurist painting in America. The Futurists had been invited to show in the Armory Show in New York in 1913. They said no. I think in retrospect, after the Armory Show got so much press, they probably regretted that decision. And so they were asked to send their work to San Francisco, and they said yes. And so there was a gallery of Futurist painting. There was a gallery of Oscar Kokoschka portraits. There were galleries devoted to Hungarian avant-garde painting. A lot of work that had not been seen in the Armory Show. So it was almost that annex was like a little mini Armory Show. And, of course, I couldn't resist ending our show with the treatment of that, because that really was the big surprise, the shock. And not everybody got it. They made fun of it. Some of them tried to understand it. And so we're bringing back together about, I'd say, probably about 90 paintings, and the rest we'll have sculpture, we'll have works on paper, we're doing photography as well. There was pictorialist photography in the Liberal Arts Pavilion. We've had a blast working on this for the last few years, and a lot of it is really just trying to identify and locate the works of art, which of course are everywhere now. Right. And so we're borrowing from really all over the world. It's great.
James, the paintings you described arriving late move against the ethos of the pre-Society for the Sanity in Art, the more traditional, almost imposed traditional tastes for sculpture at the fair. So that must have been very dramatic. Were there any protests about that or any controversy?
Yes, there was a lot of controversy. I think the women's board were upset about one of the paintings of a woman, a mother nursing or something. But in the newspapers especially, they made fun of the Futurists. This was something they could not understand. You know, the Palace of Fine Arts, it was pretty conservative. American Impressionism was really the main attraction. Of course, there was Aikens, Chase, Homer, Sargent. All of these artists we'll have in our exhibition, by the way. But it was pretty conservative. The annex was something else. And this was not a fair that included Cubism or Picasso or Matisse. They just sort of jumped from, you know, Frederick Frieseke to Boccioni. I mean, it was a pretty wild leap. And so we're excited to recreate that. I want to say one more thing. We're also showing one of the original murals from the fair by Arthur Matthews. You know, the murals were actually saved, which is kind of amazing. And some of them, the Brangwyn murals, are in the Herbst Theater at the War Memorial. But the rest of them have been pretty much in storage ever since the fair. We have one of the Arthur Matthews murals from the Court of Palms, which, when the exposition ended, was taken down. It was actually installed inside the Palace of Fine Arts. It was on public view for a number of years there. But after the mid-1920s, it was taken off public view, and we unrolled it very nervously about a year ago and found that it was actually in pretty good shape. It's been in our lab just undergoing some conservation. And we'll be showing this mural. It's 24 feet by 12 feet.
Right. One of the, I think, the exciting things on the curatorial side, especially I think for all of us, is that that sense of resurrection and bringing back some of these pieces that have not been seen. And I know a number of you have already seen our exhibition down on Mission Street, where we take the 1939 model for the GGIE, for the Golden Gate International Exposition, and we've cleaned that up a bit, and we're representing it. It's of the core of the 1915 World's Fair. So in that act and art of conservation is a real, I think, powerful rebirth, and especially in the act and art of reinterpretation, Laurie, that I can't wait for you to see. We've had a number of questions about World War I, and a number of us have touched upon it. Here is the World's Fair, and of course the war to end all wars, the first World's Fair, thank you, breaks out in August of 1914. So a number of our audience members would really like to know kind of how did that interrupt the fair. There's some great stories on how it spurred San Franciscans to incite people, don't be afraid, still come. So both postcard writing campaigns as well as very high level wooing of foreign dignitaries in the foreign consulates to make sure that they still built their pavilions. And before we answer World War I, a number of you have written questions, thank you, about the Palace of Fine Arts, which obviously as the beautiful lasting remnant of fair. Remember, all these buildings were designed to be demolished. So saving it was a truly Herculean task. I hope Jen doesn't mind, but Jen Burkfeldt, the executive director of the Maybeck Foundation, who's right there on the front row and a dear friend, knows more about the Palace of Fine Arts than I could ever hope to. But there's some very specific questions about the interpretation of the sculpture and the bas-relief, but clearly there's deep interest and love for that building. So let's go to World War I.
Well, I think there's a very high level of military awareness in the San Francisco Bay Area, right from the beginning, from Mare Island, the conquest of California in 1846 was through the military. Also, California played a major role in Senator Phelan a little later, but no, actually not a little later, a little before the establishment of the Pacific Fleet. And Mr. Moore got the Great White Fleet to come here. Admiral Robert Evans brought the fleet into San Francisco, and that was an extraordinary, powerful moment of consolidating ambition for the fair, as I know Laura will suggest. And then at the fair itself, with the Marines demonstrating landing on the beaches, there was, like California in 1939, 40, 41, when we knew we were going to get into World War II, there's at once standing off from it, at the same time a psychic relationship to the military that is increasingly going to grow. And I think you see that both in San Francisco and the San Diego Fair as well, in which military play a very important role.
Yeah, absolutely. And what happened was the war breaks out in 1914, but of course the United States does not enter it until 1917. So the immediate impact is, well, the fair is supposed to open in about 6 months, and even though the director of exhibits had deliberately overbooked the exhibit halls, foreign exhibitors start canceling in droves, and about 20% of the exhibit halls are now going to be empty. So suddenly they have to redouble their efforts to fill the halls, and there had also been a number of international events that had to be canceled or curtailed. An international polo tournament, an around-the-world air race, which probably was a very, very bad idea to start out with. And additionally, there was going to be a military tournament. What fun! And so that didn't actually happen because people were actually killing each other. And so the fair had to announce, literally, they called the president, Charles Seymour, of the fair at his country house in Santa Cruz, and they got him as he's entertaining the Argentinian commission, and they say, well, we hear there's war in Europe. Are you canceling the fair? And he had to say, with no opportunity to consult with anyone, the exposition will not be postponed. And they call it the turn of the helm that saved the ship, because even though 1915 turned out probably to be a terrible year to hold a fair, there was a worldwide recession, there was this little war going on, things like that, the next year would have been worse, and then we were in the war. And as it ended up being profitable, and they did refill the space to almost 100% capacity, 1915 was the better of the many years, but there were many, many influences of the war that you could see all over. For instance, and I won't belabor this because there's a whole chapter in the book called The Exposition Will Not Be Postponed that talks about this. One of the attractions on the zone was a electromechanical recreation of famous naval battles, and it started out being called The Evolution of the Dreadnought, and then when it didn't do very well, they re-themed it and called it The World's Wars, and it featured the sinking of the Lusitania. Yeah. So you could feel it everywhere, in the musicians who were able to come, in the attractions, in the way people treated each other. The exposition orchestra had to sign a contract that said, we will not discuss politics.
It had an enormous, the war had an enormous influence on the art. For one thing, the organizers of the art exhibition, aware that the situation was getting worse abroad, overcompensated, and they let more American art in than they probably should have, because in the end they actually did get a lot of European art, and this caused this huge problem that I've already alluded to: too much art, not enough walls. But it caused a lot of problems. The German school was very important, and the organizers had worked very hard. They were going to get 300 German paintings. Of course, this didn't happen. But as luck would have it, there was an exhibition of about 40 German paintings that happened to be on in Pittsburgh in 1914. And this was on its way back to Germany just when war was declared. The ship was taken by the British. Everything ended up in court, and they wound up sending it all back to Pittsburgh. Well, fortunately, Pittsburgh, the Carnegie Institute, was sending a lot of work to the PPIE. So we ended up with some German paintings after all. The artists won medals. They didn't even know that their work was in the fair in San Francisco. But on the other end, it caused a huge problem in terms of returning some of this work. So the German art, fortunately for the San Francisco, went back to Pittsburgh, and they had to deal with that problem. But in San Francisco, we had Austrian art, we had Hungarian art, we had Finnish art. All of this got stranded here. So the Kokoschkas, for example, they were in San Francisco until 1923, 1924, most of them on view in the Palace of Fine Arts. It's kind of amazing to think that some of this avant-garde European art stayed here and was actually on view for a really long time.
You know, I have to say, I think lender relationships were very different then, because we actually have in our collection, well, maybe I shouldn't say this publicly, but it was a sled from Admiral Perry's expedition that was lent by the Smithsonian, and we still have it. I don't think they've discovered they're missing it, but I think lender relationships were, it's much harder, I'm sure, for you to get borrow these paintings now than they were in 1915.
Right. And one of our, as my last question, three or four people have asked the same one, so I won't try and foreshadow it too much. But I'm also struck by the fair as this kind of constantly shifting place, both of safety, like signing waivers not to talk about politics. Safety was, of course, a huge concern, but it became an international problem, I think, after the outbreak of World War I, kind of started placing clouds, if you will, over the fair-going experience. But I think it was seen as kind of a neutral place. It was a place you could come into for extensive learning and exposure, and hopefully to be safe. There's so many great questions. I think we're getting to a lot of them. Two of you have asked kind of how can you contribute both your knowledge of your family's own history or your family's own collections to the broader PPIE 100 experience. And we are partnering with historypin.org. Some of you may have worked with them in the past, and we're doing an entire project just on the PPIE, and it'll be a very easy digital platform that will launch next month to upload your stories and to place memories and photos, movies, memorabilia, kind of anything you can take a picture of, not just photographs, and tell the stories behind them. So check that out, PPIE100.org. And I hope that answers your question, but I'll be happy to answer it any more. Two people want, how many more minutes do we have? 10, awesome. Two people want a saucy or sensational story about the fair. So, Kokoschka's not sensual and sexy enough. No.
So,
well, as the weather wasn't very good at the start of the fair, and they had claimed that all of the attractions on the Joy Zone Midway were going to be clean and suitable for women and children, not so much. And so a lot of the dance shows turned into girl shows as the Barbary Coast moved in. And as a PG exemplar for our audience, although, you know, you'll find much more salacious stuff in the book, they said one of the dancers' outfits was smuggled into the United States in a walnut shell.
Nice. Try that on for size. Yeah. Any other saucy stories? Jim, is there a saucy art story? There has to be saucy.
It's not really a saucy story, but it's sort of interesting. I've mentioned a couple of the people who were behind the art exhibition, Trask, Harsh, but there was another man named John Nilsen Lorvik, who was Norwegian, and maybe I did mention him. He was responsible for a lot of this stuff that was in the annex. He was quite a character. His wife was a famous patient of Sigmund Freud, and he was chosen by the San Francisco Art Association to become the director of the Art Association and also the Palace of Fine Arts, this new museum. And he gave it a go. Lorvik later separated from his wife. They never divorced. She ended up in New York City. And the interesting thing is that Lorvik had actually taken a couple of the Hungarian paintings that he intended to purchase, and he told the alien property custodian, this is the person responsible for all of the war booty, that he was the owner of these works, but he actually never paid for them. And this was Robert Berényi, the Hungarian painter, and his heirs for many years were trying to find out what happened to these things. One of them was a portrait of Béla Bartók. So when Lorvik died in New York many years later, he left a locker of stuff in San Francisco, and they opened it up and they found these two missing paintings.
Nice.
And the Bartók portrait was immediately put on the cover of High Fidelity magazine, which led the heirs to make a real effort to get this thing back. And you know what? They never got it back. And we tried to borrow this painting from its current custodian, who would not allow us to bring it back to San Francisco, unfortunately.
Well, it's hard to blame them.
I would just add one. I'm not sure this is saucy, but it's one of my favorite aspects of this, which was how the PPIE became, and Laura, you can chime in on this, it's where there became this fascination and love of Hawaiian music. Right. The ukulele. Really gathered followers at the PPIE, and so we will have some of the sheet music in the exhibition of the Hawaiian music, and you know, with hysterical names again that were not particularly flattering to Hawaiian culture, but it did very much start to draw an audience and an interest in Hawaiian music and hula dancing and ukuleles at the PPIE.
Right. Maybe some of you were of the thousands who were underneath the Palace Rotunda on Saturday last for the Yucathon. I think there are many saucy stories, whoever asked the saucy question, but I also think that we think we know 1915 in a way, like we think we know history, and then there are contours of it, whether they be, you know, racially or class-based or gender-based or sexuality-based or artistically based, that strike us as phenomenally modern and then just phenomenally, you know, painful. Remember, this is also the year of the first moving picture with Birth of a Nation, and so that simultaneity of the modern, this is an ultimately modern fair, but that looks back, you know, decades, generations to a fuzzy, hazy, romanticized version of classicism. And it's a very kind of rich, intense, and complicated moment. And in that, of course, I think we see so much similarities. Okay. Could San Francisco / Silicon Valley and of course, the Greater East Bay ever pull off something on the scale of the PPIE again? And would we want to?
Well, I would like to chime in. There every once in a while, a group comes forward and says, why don't we do it? And I would caution that every time we have a World's Fair, we get a world war.
That's right. 1939 didn't turn out very well.
Maybe it's not the best idea. But I would certainly love to see one. And generally, they're done not so much for profit, but for redevelopment of an area.
Or do you think something like the, say, the great digital convention and trade show at Las Vegas, which grows every year into something more magnificent, is the equivalent of as a fair issue? Or when you look at, say, 100 million people watching the Super Bowl, have we reached out so far that to spatialize something, to bring people in like this, is being taken care of by our mass media now?
Well, that's really the problem with the World's Fair. I don't know if anyone here knows, but Expo 2015 will be held this year in Milan. There are still World's Fairs about every 5 years. And we can live in this world and not know there's a World's Fair, whereas in 1915, you were not in an industrialized country and didn't know about this fair. But you could also come to the PPIE and pretty much see all the latest in agricultural machinery, where now you would need a CES or another huge trade show just specifically for that trade. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it was the infancy of movies. We were just about to get broadcast radio. There was no broadcast television and no airplane travel for the masses. No internet, of course. And so, yes, there's the trade show. Yes, there's the gigantic sporting event, giant concerts. And the PPIE kind of served as all of those things in 1915.
It's well said, yeah. The World Wide Web on 635 acres. Yeah. And your thoughts on that, on the possibilities of it all? It's a great question, and I think we get that a lot as historians. Like, why could Bay Bridge, you know, famous one right now, 75th anniversary of the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, could we ever build a bridge like that? And I think for all of us, there remains a deep sense of wonder that they were able to really to pull it off. And I think that's captivated all of us as we've been preparing for the various roles that we have in this centenary, of the real kind of drama of it, of the scale of it, of the scope of it, and to think really of the power of that thought, of the city of the imagination, if you will. And then a couple hundred thousand people closed the fair?
I think it was the biggest day, and I believe it was something like 400,000 people.
Closed the fair on the 6th of December in 1915. 4th of December. Been corrected by the mistress. 1915. But in a really kind of almost upbeat way. And maybe we can close. We have a minute left. And maybe we can just kind of share it wasn't seemingly too dour or sad. It was kind of the great new beginning of San Francisco.
Well, it was a wonderful, the biggest fireworks show they'd ever seen. President Charles Seymour went to each building and ceremonially closed it. They rang down a wreath over the great court of the universe. And then at midnight, after letting people dance in the court of the universe to several different bands, they turned out all the main lights one by one, finally leaving a single spotlight on Descending Night by Adolf Weinmann, and then they turned it off. And Art Smith went up in his plane and wrote in fireworks across the sky, "Farewell, PPIE." They left the emergency lights on, and people danced till dawn, and then they filed exhaustedly out of the fair.
And that, my dear friends, closes our program. Thank you so much.